In the summer of 1893, Uncle Ebenezer was in Rocky Ford, Colorado, visiting with two men who happened to be on the school board. They were complaining about not being able to keep a principal at the school. Every winter, the cowboys from outlying ranches would come in and take delight in causing a disturbance and running the principal off. One of them said they would pay $100 a month to a man who the cowboys couldn't run off. Uncle Eb said that he could get just the man that would fill the bill. He sent a wire to my father that he had a job for him at $100 a month. He didn't mention any contingencies or liabilities. Dad was only getting $60 a month where he was, so he popped the question to Mother, she accepted, and they headed to Rocky Ford on their honeymoon. They stopped at the World's Fair in Chicago, where Dad was robbed of all his money. Mother had the train tickets in a small purse around her neck under her blouse. So they arrived in Rocky Ford broke and hungry.
I was born with the devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing.
Hello and good evening. I'm Douglas Bowles, and you're listening to 42 Minutes, a production of SyncBook Radio and thesyncbook.com, a weekly conversation with the interesting artists and thinkers of our day. You can find us online at 42minutes.com, and you can reach us by sending a message to mail at 42minutes.com. You can also follow our tweets at Sync42 and at SyncBook. It's 2015, yet instead of a vision of God, we're going back in time to 1893 to meet the devil.
And we'll do so in a holiday house located in the White City. Hello, Alan Green here, and tonight for 42 Minutes, we're considering a concept album inspired by Eric Larson's 2003 novel, The Devil in the White City. The album Night Falls on the Fair by Illinois duo Holiday House explores the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. But don't expect giddy tributes to the first Ferris wheel. Night Falls on the Fair consistently sounds ominous, as if serial killer H.H. Holmes is only one of many evils awaiting visitors to the event. Holiday House consists of Andrea Donahue and Paul Wendell Lucas, and together they make honest, brooding, and hopeful music that bleeds. More information about them can be found at their Bandcamp page, holidayhouse.bandcamp.com. It's a pleasure to be meeting with Paul this evening. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So today we're doing things a bit differently than we normally would. I'm not even supposed to be here. This is 42 minutes, not even my show. But we have yet another added addition to today's 42 minutes. We're going to bring in Andras Jones and Radio 8-Ball to not only introduce the listeners to your music, but to kind of set the tone. Andras, welcome to 42 Minutes.
Thank you, Alan. It's great to be here. I love 42 Minutes. And wherever you are, Will, take a toke from me. So, yeah, well, we have the Holiday House record here, and we have them in the shuffler. And what we're going to do is engage the Pop Oracle the way that we do, which is by asking a question and then picking a song at random and interpreting that randomly chosen song as the answer to the question, like picking a musical tarot card. And in this case, the Oracle fodder from which we will draw the answers are going to be the songs from Holiday House, Night Falls on the Fair. Now, who pray tell is asking this question?
That would be I, Paul Wendell Lucas.
Ah, so you'll be looking into the mirror and asking a question. So
there's a mirror across from me right now. So.
Excellent. Well, what is your question for the Pop Oracle?
Oh boy. My question to the Pop Oracle, which is, I'm doing a little Saturday Night Live guy where I'm staring into myself in the mirror, and I want to know, am I good enough? Am I strong enough? And God darn it, do people like me? No, I don't want to ask that. Let's see. My question is, for the Pop Oracle, what sort of adventure it lies in the afterlife? Is there one? And will I enjoy it?
What sort of adventure lies in the afterlife? Is there one? And will you enjoy it?
That's what came out of my mouth right now.
Awesome. Okay, someone write that down so we can refer to it later. We're going to pick a CD, pick a song at random. I'm just going to play the whole album on shuffle function. Usually we do 8 songs, but the album has 9 songs, and we figure we'll just go with the whole thing. So here we go, and whatever song is chosen is the answer to the question. When it's over, we'll come back and figure out what it means. And that was Closing Ceremonies from Holiday House, Night Falls on the Fair. The answer to Paul's question, what adventure awaits in the afterlife? Is there one? And will I enjoy it? So, well, you're intimately familiar with that record and that song. What did you make of that as the answer to your question?
Man, that was really something. That's the last track on the record, and I listened to the whole thing today to kind of familiarize myself. We did that in one take and didn't practice it or something. It was the last song we wrote too, and it was quick and swift and ended everything for the record. And it's Silence Over Us, and it's not brimming with happiness like you might hope that question would be, you know, answered with, but it's brimming with solidarity and, you know, a realness and a peace, sort of. It's the quietest song on the record, as, you know, final songs tend to be. So that's a monster. I really didn't know what I was going to ask, and I didn't know what I was going to hear, and that's definitely got my, you know, the hairs on my arm raised.
Is there any connection between the song and the story that it's based upon, and how that fits into why that has the hairs standing up on your arm?
Yeah. At the end of the fair, which is kind of funny because we're starting the show sort of backwards. The end of the fair, the way it ended, they were planning to do a great closing ceremony for the World's Fair, but it got interrupted because the mayor of Chicago at the time was assassinated two nights before they were going to do closing ceremonies. Instead of doing closing ceremonies where they were going to burn down the fair and let it be over with, they were going to literally blow it up. They ended up having a parade for the now deceased mayor of Chicago. That's what we wrote that song about.
Interesting. So the, you know, when I was listening to it, and I want to hear what Doug and Alan think, but what I was hearing, there was the one line that kept repeating was "silence over us,"
mm-hmm.
which could suggest that there, you know, it's like, imagine there's no heaven kind of thing, like
sure.
above us yeah. only sky. But then there was the line about ghosts will dance in a masquerade, which again made me feel like maybe what we think of as the afterlife is really, like everything else, just a projection of the current life, and that the ghosts are a part of a masquerade.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm getting the lines right.
You are getting the lines right.
So, yeah, it seemed like a potent answer as far as something you can, you know, you want to base your future travel plans on. I think yeah. like the Radio 8 Ball often does, it gave us an answer wrapped in paradox, but one that I think because of the music particularly, it part of the answer is in the words, and then another part of the answer is in the music, and then another part of it is in the context. And the music of that definitely put me in the headspace of pondering what's after. It put me, sure. it made me feel in solidarity with your question.
Right.
Now, Doug and Alan.
I particularly like that you honed in on that line of the ghosts dancing, because that does seem to answer maybe that third part of that question of will I enjoy it? And because it also answers the second part of the question, is there an afterlife? We have ghosts dancing, so that's, I guess that's kind of answered. But I liked, Paul, when you're saying of how the World's Fair was meant to end, it sounds almost like a Burning Man, you know, just burn it down, blow it up. It's very, not only grand in a spectacle sort of way, but it's highly symbolic and something that we kind of, it's making my head spin, the idea of the Burning Man connected with an assassination. But regardless, I like the idea that so you're supposed to have this grand spectacle, and instead what you have is this sort of mournful parade. And it makes me think of that line, you know, this is how the end comes, not with a bang, but with a whimper.
Right.
You know, it's sort of whatever grand adventure you're picturing, when the time comes, it'll probably, even if it doesn't have to be a sad thing per se, but certainly bittersweet. And sort of how the tone of the song goes is, and even if we went on to a wonderful afterlife, I no doubt would be a bittersweet experience to leave this one behind. So.
Sure.
For whatever reason, I zeroed in on the fact that the song is 3 minutes and 30 seconds long. And I wondered what that was saying too. So that we're thinking about the idea of the afterlife and whether or not there is one, but what that means. And so Alan was talking about, I like that he zeroed in on dancing as as a continuation of life. So afterlife, and my 33 maybe contributes to that a little bit, that it's just, it's the next level.
Right.
You mean 33 is in terms of like 33rd degree Freemasonry, or like what's the 33 sink for you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it also, it's the temperature at which ice melts?
Jesus is 33, right. 33 vertebrae. It just seems like that's the end of the line.
It's funny that I played the last song on the record on face, you know, straight up face value. That is really, really mind boggling to me, really, you know, like, because, you know, this record actually was, it was a blowout. It was, we wanted it to be like The Fair, and it ended up echoing that in reality, as certain things do. We spent everything we had, we emotionally and, you know, mentally. And so this, and we really did just do this one song, and, you know, that's it. It was the end, you know, it really was the end. And Silence Over Us, I forget exactly what that came from, but I think it was just, you know, it doesn't have to go out with a, you know, but maybe life doesn't go out with a bang. It goes out with silence, you know, which is kind of a nice thought, you know, just quiet, you know,
but
silence.
The show, today's show, the end is the beginning.
Right, right, that too.
So we're gonna move on into the afterlife of this Radio 8 Ball segment and kind of get deeper into the album as a whole, your music, and what role you played in bringing this album to life. Along with some of the real life synchronicities of the story, the true story that this album is based on. Andras, I want to thank you for your participation today. Is there anything you want to say before you leave us?
If you want to get your question answered, you should go check out the Pop Oracle at radio8ball.com, where you can get a question answered anytime you want. And also check out all of the exciting stuff around Radio 8 Ball podcasts, web series, cupcakes, and bowler hats. So come on down to get them all. And thanks a lot for having me as a part of this. And I'll probably just hang on and listen until I have to jump away. But consider this my sayonara to the 42 minutes.
Cool. Well, I eagerly await my Radio 8 Ball cupcake.
Yeah.
Would love one of those. So Paul, maybe we can kind of move in that direction. Tell us a little bit about your background, you both musically, and what you did for this album, what role you played.
Well, this record was a spawn of Holiday House, which was me and my friend Andrea Donahue. We started working together in about 2007. And it was always acoustic guitar, kind of me and her, but we always strived to do more. And, so we were like, we had like, you know, we went from six people in the band back to two over the course of, however many years. And, at the end we decided, let's lay it all down, me and you, mano a mano, like, let's put every instrument that we can envision on here. Let's like go all out. And we needed a theme, and at some point, Devil in the White City fell into my lap, and it seemed like the songs we were writing were already gelling to that, and that was just the mold that fell on top and cut it and was like, this is it, this is what you're going to do, like, this is your answer. You know, like, I needed a direction, a finality, so we went back to songs that were already you know, gelling, and we started to direct them in the way of The Fair. And we're from Chicago, of course, so we spent some time in Jackson Park and looked around and what it is now, and really, really got into it, embraced it 100%, and went for it.
Well, so there, start there. So who is the devil, and what is the White City? I mean, we've winked at it, but could you introduce our listeners to that? And
sure. Well, in plain history, or in the book, the devil is H.H. Holmes, Holiday House Holmes, to, you know, something that I was really transfixed by during the making of. He was a doctor who lived in Chicago and built a hotel before the World's Fair opened, and it was called the World's Fair Hotel. And he attracted visitors there, but it was actually really not a hotel at all. It was a place built for killing innocent victims from all around the country that were coming to the fair and, you know, not used to the big city. And he would bring them in, marry them, hire them, get them a room, and they wouldn't get out of there. So that he was the devil of the White City. And the White City refers to the buildings of the Chicago Fair, which were white stucco that were illuminated by some of the first light bulbs produced by from energy by Nikola Tesla. And that was the White City. And there is crazy significance to the people who were there. And just, it was right at the turn of the century. It was, I read today, you know, like, a dry run of what we were going to do for the next 100 years. Like, it was really like Disneyland, you know, part one. And it was Epcot.
When you look at the pictures, it's just astounding because it looks so monumental.
Oh, yeah.
But then you find out that for all intents and purposes, it's all fake, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is the I spoke with my older brother today. Rather randomly, and I told him about this interview, and he was like, well, you know, the devil is also a falsehood. It's presenting something that isn't, you know, and he was like, so I think that it's very interesting, and he's never read the book or anything. He just thought it was interesting that, you know, from his knowledge, he just knows that, you know, Chicagoans know there's nothing much left of what happened here for all its significance in history. We have very little homage to it. And he was like, well, the devil is falsehood. But he wasn't even speaking about H.H. Holmes. So I thought that was really interesting. It wasn't built to last. You know, it was just a falsehood, the whole thing.
Well, I assume if they were building it, if it was their intention from the get-go to burn it or blow it up, you know, it's sort of... you're designing something with the impermanence... there, it's almost like a movie set. You put up the facade, but you don't put any plumbing in because you know that it's not going to be there.
Doug, do you know anything about, like, do you remember, I think it might have been implied in the book that they weren't entirely sure what to do at the end. The whole thing was kind of a hodgepodge. It was like so political, and you know, Chicago beat out New York for this, and Washington DC and Pittsburgh, which were at the time is crazy because we had just burned down our entire real city with the Chicago fire, you know, 10 years prior, not even something like that, you know? So I don't know that it was their intention from the get-go to burn it down at the end. I think they didn't know what to do. I think they were in such a hurry to, in a Jurassic Park, Goldblum kind of way, they were in such a hurry to do it that they didn't think of how to get out of it. And that ended up kind of biting them in the ass in the end. I think midway through, they were like, let's blow it up, you know. But I don't know if it was built with the sole intention to burn it down. Also, burning down the mock city that you just built in, you know, right after the entire city really burnt down is kind of, you know, mind-blowing, you know. Pretty ballsy, you ask me.
Another interesting fact is that it wasn't called the Chicago World's Fair, that it was the Columbian Exposition.
Yeah. It brought us Columbus Day. Thank you very much. Celebrating, you know, America's favorite guy, you know, unquestionably.
Right, because it was anniversary of his 400th.
Right.
Wait, that's crazy. So you're telling me this? We have the serial killer... with Columbia, and so I'm bringing my sink head into this. Anyway, it was my mind just started spinning there of all these different sort of name games and weird connections in that sense. How did how did you tackle writing about a serial killer musically? Did that affect the tone of the music, or was the tone kind of already in that ominous place?
It was definitely already there. And, you know, this was like the driving force, you know, when I found out, because people here in Chicago do not know about H.H. Holmes. He is not, you know, everyone knows Jack the Ripper. Everyone. And you don't even need to live in London. Here in Chicago, you can ask anyone, and you can go to the very site where his murder castle was, where he built a whole, you know, hotel for the explicit reason to kill people, and nobody knows about it. So, you know, that's so interesting to me. So when I learned about it, I was like, man, I'm here, you know, like, and this happened and no one talks about it. And it's just, I don't know what the reason is that he's not, you know, for the dark side of me, and for, you know, that we know that we love celebrating, so like serial killers. This was the first one, and he was the craziest, like the lengths that he went to. I mean, it's just, you know, it makes Jack the Ripper look like, you know, I don't want to get dirtier, but it makes him look like nothing, like Elmo, kind of, to me, like slashing up people in an alley. This guy built a whole house.
Right, this is like the Saw movies or something. You're going to build a... Right. That's a hell of a commitment to murder.
Oh, God. He had to hire people. It took a year to build. He had to hire and fire and hire and fire. They go over it in the book, and the doors... You don't even understand. The doors were... They locked when you walked into the room. They locked from the outside only. And they had gas chambers... And he had floorboards that would lift up and slide the bodies down to the basement, where he had incinerators. Like, Stephen King has never come up. If he did, he wouldn't, you know, he's never come up with anything this crazy, because you just wouldn't believe it. You know, it's not a story you can sell. It's just unbelievable. It really is.
And I recently heard Eric Larson speak about his book.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that was the hardest part, was he had... So the strange thing about him as a writer is that he's writing true crime that reads like fiction.
Right.
So the way it's like journalism, where he wants to tell a really interesting story, but there needs to be enough history because everything has to be documented. And the hardest part is these two stories actually don't really connect. So the White City and the murders are connected only in vicinity. Could you, I mean, it's been so long since I read that book. What makes it, when I read it, I remember it being so gripping too. What was it that gripped you, that caused you to want to, you know, take that influence into music?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't remember what came first, you know, like, but... whatever clicked. You know what's odd? I'll be honest with you. I think the first thing that clicked for me between the story has nothing to do with H.H. Holmes. It, honest to God, has to do with the Ferris wheel. When I was reading about that, there was a great... stop me if I'm switching gears too hard here, because I could go on about H.H. Holmes forever. But the Ferris wheel aspect was really interesting to me, because they were so reluctant to build it. No one understood what it was. Like, you know, it just looked like a dangerous death contraption. But it was really, and it was the first amusement ride, and no one understood it, you know, and they were like, you get on it and it goes in a circle and you get off at the bottom and you've experienced something, you know, and that was like really interesting to me. And the reluctance to build that all along, you know, planning to, you know, where you have the serial killer outside on the grounds, you know, taking women in and killing them. Like, we were worried about this thing blowing over, which makes sense, but it was fine. It was the Ferris wheel, you know, it was the first ride, you know, and that's what really pulled me in. I started thinking about a Ferris wheel just big time, and the bravery it would take, because that's a scary ride. I still get scared on Ferris wheels, you know, like they're discomforting and they're beautiful and awesome. And so I was like, well, I'm going to, and I was obsessed with Bill Hicks at the time and his, you know, it's just a ride speech. And I thought really life is most like he explains it as kind of a roller coaster with thrills and chills. But I thought of it more as a, you know, the circle where you never know where you really at until you're looking down and you're like, oh, I'm not at the bottom, or the bottom, and you're like, oh, I'm not at the top, or you're in the middle and you don't know where the hell you are.
So yeah, that really, was your description of the Ferris wheel really made me think of back to your Radio 8 Ball question. You know, this idea of you're asking, is there an adventure in the afterlife? But then when you said your description of a Ferris wheel was you get on and it goes around and you go up and you have this experience and then you're at back at the bottom and you get off, and no one knew what the hell to make of that. And that's kind of, I imagine, when I reach the end of my life, I'm going to turn around and go, what the hell was that?
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes you think you've reached the end, and like a Ferris wheel, where I've made more of a point to get on those things when I see them. You know, it takes you around a few times, and depending on who the operator is, you're not really sure when they're going to open the thing. And sometimes you get a trance, and like they open the door at the end of it, and you're like, oh shit, you know, I haven't, you know, I'm not even done kissing the girl that I'm on here with, you know, whatever, you know, like, or I'm in the trance, you know, and you don't expect the ride operator to let you off. You're like, what the hell? And that's it, you know. So it's a romantic ride too. It's, you know, that's the first thing I was like, well, you know, Ferris wheel, wow. Like, you know, just thinking about the first ride. That's what first brought me to thinking about Devil in the White City.
Actually, I've been reading too much Manly P. Hall, and so when you talk about that, I can't help but think of the idea of the Wheel of Fortune, or this notion of a perennial philosophy where, because of the seasons and the sun and things, we have this. But the problem I'm having is I'm mixing together this notion of a fallen state and the perennial philosophy. So there is the cycle of death and rebirth that's necessary for life, but then I also am feeling in the cycle this emphasis of a fallen state, which definitely, I know we're talking about
night falls on the fair.
Right.
So right, everyone's having fun and here the silence descends.
Right. And Illinois especially, you know, I talk about fallen states and, you know, a state run by crooked governors, and there was that to begin with. There was the way that we like Marshall Field and J.P. Morgan were two huge players in Chicago that helped bring the fair here. And that's of, you know, you could stare at that all day and just be like, oh my God, because, you know, Marshall Fields is famous in Chicago for, you look at their, we just went through Christmas, you look at their Christmas windows, you know, and they're famous. You stare at the windows and watch the puppets do their thing. And he was, you know, the ultimate salesman, and he put in millions of dollars to get the fair here to start selling, you know, to start selling the American dream in the midst of the Depression through this Epcot Center idea, you know.
Do you happen to know what the mayor who was assassinated, do you happen to know what the controversy was that would have brought someone to assassinate him?
Yeah, it was a deranged, for a better word, it was a strange guy. He thought that he had like some meeting with him, and he was convinced that he was the next governor. He felt cheated out of office. He wrote a lot of postcards that Eric got a hold of and read, and he went to the governor's house, or the mayor's house, I'm sorry. And actually, in those days, like, he actually shot him in his house because somebody answered the door, and the mayor, like, came, you know, was in a good mood and came to the door to see what, you know, a standing citizen wanted to ask, and he blasted him, you know. And that's, like, that's pretty, why don't people, you know, people don't know that. And that's, Eric Larson is really the only person to tell the story, and that's unbelievable to me, you know.
Doug. So it turns out that Doug not only read The Devil in the White, when I told Doug that I was going to be speaking to you, not only had he read Devil in the White City, but the story he told at the beginning of today's episode is a true story. There was a personal history there. And Doug, did you not also say that there was someone else who had written about this time period?
Yeah. So yeah, that reading, my reading at the very beginning was actually my great-great-grandfather when he was coming to Colorado. On the way, on his way to Colorado, he and his wife were on his honeymoon. They stop at the Chicago World's Fair and they got robbed of everything.
No. And, wow.
Yeah. And luckily, great-great-grandma had the train tickets under her blouse. And so this tiny little bit kind of, I went through this strange phase where I was really looking back and wondering, you know, who am I? And so, you know, I was thinking, I don't know why, but like I went back to there, and a book that really spoke to me when I was thinking about these things was Jimmy Corrigan, The World's Greatest Kid. Have you ever read that one? No, the smartest Jimmy Corrigan, the smartest kid on earth.
No, I can't say as I've have not.
It's an incredible graphic novel. Incredible. It's super dense and it's not easy to read, but it's beautiful and it's worth the time. But the Chicago World's Fair is like one of the central pieces to this thing. And so when you get to the fair and he starts opening it up with these beautiful illustrations of the different exhibits and the grandeur of the grounds themselves.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. And then you really get a sense of, like you're saying, this just the scale of this thing. You know, it's the turn of the century. Let's just do something as much as we can.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, even the Paris itself, the biggest cities in the world boast still. You can think of those Paris wheels in your head. We did that on a marshland in the Windy City, you know? Like, like that's the most daring, like, ballsy thing I've ever heard of. And they were the size of buses, like the carts you would ride on. This thing was massive.
You contacted us, Paul. I mean, this is... you're a musician. You're inspired by the writings of this other Eric Larson. You've been a musician for a while. Where does synchronicity and our little crew kind of come into your world, and how does that intersect with your art?
Well, I'm not sure when I was introduced. To you guys specifically, I know it was from Bill Klaus, and I think that there's one thing, and I'm not, you know, I don't know if Bill's going to kill me for saying this, but like I had a instance on a Salvia once, and I'm pretty sure this kicked things off in a sort of a tangent, you know, Ferris wheel sort of way for me and him. I had a really deep, like very mystical experience on that stuff. And I was in my apartment at the time. And I had to leave, and the first place I went just to get away from my head where it went, because it was kind of terrifying, was to a bar that Bill was working at. And he didn't miss a beat. He did not ask me anything other than he stomped right over to me, and I was feeling very vulnerable at the time. And he's like, what is it? What did you just do? What did you just see? You know? And he was like, I want to know. And I told him about, then sometime after that, you know, I think he just straight up told me about you guys, and he was excited. He was somebody I talked to during the making of the record, and he knows Andrea. They work together, and so he was, you know, very much a part of it, and always supportive. You know how great it is to talk to that guy, and so that's where my introduction to you comes from. In terms of making the record, I had some really weird, I had one really in particular during the production of the record, a weird thing happened to me. I, out of the blue, kind of did the Chicago half marathon without a lot of practice. Like I started running, but I didn't really, you know, I'm not a professional runner by any means or anything. And I went on this thing and I think I was starting to get it and I was starting to get the scope of the record and, I was starting to like think about Sync, and I might have by then bought Sync Book 2, and I was running this thing, and it was in the middle of production, and there was times, like anything else, where I thought I might lose grip of the record, and it might, you know, just turn out bad, or I might, like, just lose my mind over it, and it might fall apart, and I might, you know, anything could happen. It could burn down before it's ever done. And in the middle of it, I did this run, and it ended at the statue, which is one homage to the World's Fair in Chicago, which is referred to as Big Mary, which is this huge golden statue on the south side. Turns out the half marathon ended at that. So I'm running, and I'm like half dead running, finishing this thing I had no business doing. And there's this this big golden woman, which is a statue from the fair, a recreation, but, you know, still there in the middle of Lakeshore Drive. And that was the finish line. That was it. That was when you were done. That was the line was there. That was where the line was drawn. And I ran through it, and I was like, you know, just overwhelmed. I was like, oh, I'm going to finish this, I guess. You know, it's got to get done. And that was big. That was like, you know, life altering almost, because I had no idea that you know, I just didn't know that that's where the race ended. And it meant a lot to me at that time. And weird stuff like that pops up all the time.
Especially, yeah, that's sort of how that's the sort of thing where you can't sort of shake that out of your head once something like that happens. That's a pretty real powerful moment right there.
Very much so.
Ton of sympathy for that kind of experience. Yeah.
Yeah. I have anytime I talk to any of you guys, it cracks me up because something strange is bound to happen. It's just inexplicable. I've made contact, and even saying made contact, I really feel like it's just like, I know there's a risk involved in talking to any of you guys, whether it be Bill or Doug or Alan, any of you guys, Andres, with that song at the beginning of the show, you know, kicked my head in. It is contact to me, and I think that contact is, you know, if you will it and if you ask for it, it'll come, you know, and it might freak you out of it. And you guys are definitely touching on something that I think is the UFO, is the afterlife thing. It's far beyond strange, you know. It's not even like it's beyond what you wish for. It's not, you just do something and it's going to prove itself to you in a way that you didn't even see coming. Like you go to make a record and you pour yourself into it, and at the same time you're going to get signals from other things. If you dedicate yourself to a craft, to an art, these other vigils will come up and they'll like knock you on the head, and you'll be like, then you'll, it's kind of just a reminder. And I don't know where it comes from. I really don't, but it's a reminder to say, hey, you know, like you're going the right way, you know, finish this, do it. And, you know, they can come up every day, or, and maybe if you're not seeing them, you know, you got to focus a different way and get passionate about something, get excited again, and it'll arise, and it'll just freak you out, you know.
What are you working on these days? Do you have another like fleshed out concept, or are you just exploring with your music?
Well, I'd say that I'm exploring with the music, and I play drums as well. So there's one project that's just kind of like where I'm letting this guy do his thing, and I'm playing drums. But there's another one that is a little more, I don't know where it's coming from. It's it's called Milk Dud McKenzie, which is kind of a joke name, but all the best things I think come from a joke. And we're working on things that are definitely influenced from the more research I do into, you know, the esoteric, the cool stuff. It's being influenced, just like writing Nightfalls. It's I'm trying to write, in one way it's about, you know, it's about the World's Fair, and all other way it's just about surviving and you know, and life and death, you know, Dostoevsky stuff, you know, it's got to be about like five different things. So yeah, there's stuff on the burner, and I don't know how it's going to come out. I don't know how it's going to get done, just like I didn't know how this thing, this Nightfalls thing ever would, but You know, it'll see its light. I wanted to bring up, speaking to my older brother today, and I was talking about make-believe cities that come into fruition. Actually, one guy that I know knew personally was Fred Rogers from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And
knew him personally?
Yeah, he was my dad's best. Him and my father were very, very close friends.
That's wild.
Yeah. And I wouldn't have even brought it up if I didn't call my older brother today. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm doing that podcast later. And he's like, oh, yeah, tell me, I'm going to listen to it. I'm like, well, you can't yet. And he's like, so what is he? He's actually Muslim, and he can't listen to, like, everything. And, like, it's kind of like he's, you know, got certain rules about things. But he was like, you know, I always thought it was very strange about the land of make-believe, you know. And that cracked me up because I had never even – that was huge to me. Huge to me as a child. I was obsessed with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And that actually led to my dad meeting him. They made a contact through something, and my dad and him just hit it off like a house fire. And he would come over, and I knew him well, yeah.
So what kind of secret can you tell us? What is really on the other side of that train?
I am not totally at liberty to say everything, but I can say that he had a tough childhood, and he really hated television with a burning passion and was really freaked out about it. One of the first things he ever saw on TV was his parents were wealthy, and they brought home one of the first TVs in his neighborhood, and they plugged it in, and he saw, like, you know, a clown hit another clown in the pie with the face, and he was horrified. You know, he was scared shitless by it. And he was like, there's got to be something else, you know, to show kids. And he kind of, I mean, he was a fascinating guy, and he really wanted what was best for people, you know. Like, he really wanted people to, television to be a discovery for oneself, just say, hey, it's okay. You know, like, that was his medium. And he was unbelievable. You know, that guy really was. It's unfortunate on the internet there's stuff about him being a Marine with, you know, these tattoos. You know, like, I don't know if you've even heard that. But he was the real deal. He really just cared about people being all right. That's all he wanted. He really wanted to maximize the message, like, that's okay, you know. Like, it's okay to get your hair cut. It's okay to be mad. It's okay to be scared of your dad. Like, crazy stuff. Like, you know, he dropped some heavy, heavy messages on kids. So.
Did he have kids himself?
He did, yeah. I can't honestly say what that relationship is, you know, if, you know, but he did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's okay. We're not. I don't think we're looking for a gossipy thing. Well, I was sort of thinking it actually when I asked the question. I was sort of asking it in a joking way. I meant, what is really like? I mean, it's more like Bill asking you, what did you see on your Salvia trip? I wasn't really asking what Mr. Rogers was like in real life. I'm asking, what do you think is really? It's kind of like your what adventure waits in the afterlife. What is really in the land of make believe? What do you? As a musician, as someone who's tapped into creative forces, psychedelic forces, all different types of muses and headspaces, what for you sort of lies in that land of make-believe?
The land of make-believe is actually one of the strangest places I can think of. It is truly bizarre. That's a very good question because... I mean, as a kid, it was all I ever wanted to watch, and it did introduce me to music, and it was an obsession of mine. And so only child me could answer that, and I would love to ask him that, but I really don't know. It's really strange. If you watch the show, it's really far out there. And it's not Teletubbies or Barney, like Goofy, like stoner stuff. It's really strange. Let's see. I don't know. He controlled everything, and he did every voice of every puppet, and he made every puppet. You know, like, he really controlled that whole monster. So it was just, It was just him. It was just Fred. Did you guys ever watch that video where he got money from the Senate? He took money from the Senate that was supposed to be spent on the Vietnam War and convinced them to give it to PBS.
No, I've never seen this.
That's got to be the first thing you look at. Holy moly. It is insane. It'll come up super easy on YouTube. He was, he convinced them to take money from Vietnam and pay for his show. And he had to speak to the Senate and be like, and he just does math. That is magic. And that fascinated me. How the conviction that he speaks with is just unreal. He just really just did not want bombs to fall, and he just wanted kids to feel okay. And that thing will blow really. If it doesn't make you cry, I don't know. If it doesn't at least like rattle you, nothing will. It's just really, really daring, really cool.
But then, so the strangest thing is that we said this show we're going to meet a devil, and then we spent so much time with Fred Rogers. I'm just kind of blown away.
We got the devil out right at the beginning. We expected it was going to be something hellish, and it turned out, you know, turned out pretty nice.
just the guy.
Our afterlife is, you know, Mr. Rogers, land of make believe. That's pretty good.
I'm just afraid it's gonna be just as confusing as this one, you know.
That was 42 minutes. Thank you for sharing it with us. You've been listening to Paul Obis on SyncBook Radio, a production of thesyncbook.com. Information about the work of Holiday House can be found at holidayhouse.bandcamp.com. For more information about the SyncBook, our guests, check out past shows, or subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Please be sure and visit our website at 42minutes.com. If you'd like to support the show, we urge you to become a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and I don't think that I would have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes.